Haaretz is currently celebrating 100,000 paying subscribers. If you're not already subscribed to Israel's oldest daily newspaper, go to haaretz.com and sign up today. Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... After a joyous weekend of Olympic celebration here in Israel, we turn our attention this week to a far less heartwarming issue. The ongoing, unreported killing of Palestinians by Israeli forces in the West Bank. Over the weekend, a Palestinian father of five was killed during demonstrations adjacent to the West Bank outpost of Eviatar. And less than 2 weeks ago, a 12-year-old boy was shot and killed by IDF forces in Beit Umar. According to adversary group Defense for Children Palestine, he was the 11th Palestinian child to be killed in the West Bank this year. Joining me to discuss the routine of violence in the occupied Palestinian territories, I'm delighted to welcome back to the pod Haaretz's West Bank correspondent, Hagar Shezaf. How are you, Hagar?
I'm well, thank you.
So, Hagar, tell me, who was Mohammed al-Alami?
He was a 12 years old, I think his actually 12th birthday was supposed to be in September. 12 years old boy from Beit Umar who was shot dead by Israeli soldiers about 2 weeks ago. He was shot while he was sitting in his father's car and he was shot while the car was actually still moving.
Do we know what happened in the incident? Do we know how the soldiers ended up shooting at this car that was carrying this young boy and his family?
Yeah, so it's actually one of the stories where everything kind of comes together, like the eyewitness account and the IDF's response and also footage that was later released by B'Tselem. What we know, I'll kind of take it from maybe the end of the story, is that El-Alami was shot while he was sitting in his father's car. The family was coming back from shopping. They, you know, went to the town's supermarket and they were in a car, father, Hamad, and a brother and a sister of his. And after they were done shopping, they started driving towards their home. While driving there, the father noticed soldiers. So he began to reverse. While the car was reversing, soldiers started shooting towards its direction. The car then turned around, did like a little U-turn. And then the fire actually hit the car. So we see bullet signs from the side of the car. And then they continued shooting towards the back of the car. And it's most probable that Mohammed was actually killed from the bullets that hit the side of the car because he was sitting at the back seat. And so what we know for sure is that when the soldiers started and, you know, and continued shooting the car, it wasn't moving towards their direction, because very often in the West Bank, the IDF would tell you later that, you know, this a car was driving quickly towards the soldiers and they thought it might be a ramming attack. No, here, like right from the start, actually, the IDF never said that.
The soldiers never felt that their lives were being threatened in any way. This wasn't a preventative
shooting. No, it wasn't preventative. We know that from, you know, from eyewitnesses and from the video and from the bullet signs. But the thing was that the IDF actually didn't say that to begin with. Like right at their very first response, they never claimed that, you know, the soldiers felt threatened, which is kind of their go-to, right? Excuse or reasoning for shooting. So here, like, you have a very, you know, distinct case where there was no need to shoot at all. I mean, of course, you can always claim and always say that there is no reason to shoot. But here, like, really, the car wasn't even facing the soldiers. It's all very unclear. The other kind of like strange aspect to the story is the back The background story of how it all began. Because what I was told by an eyewitness, and actually it also matches the IDF's response, was that shortly before the car in which Muhammad was sitting arrived to the location, there was another Palestinian family who gathered near a place that is like an informal cemetery for for stillborn and for like very young babies. So it's not like the village's cemetery, but it's this location where, you know, everybody in the village were like, they know that that's what is being done in this location. And so there was a Palestinian family there burying a very, very young baby. And the soldiers who are always situated at the entrance to Beit Umar, and maybe we can talk in a bit about why is that, because I think it's crucial to like understand the story and how it came about. But anyway, so the soldiers who were around there apparently saw this family. You know, they don't know anything about, you know, the customs or anything, I guess, to do with the village or Palestinian culture or whatever. So they, being soldiers, assumed that they are dealing with some sort of explosive. And so the soldiers came there, apparently after the burial was done, they came there trying to look for, you know, what was it that the family buried there. And then they uncovered the body of the very young baby. And what the IDF claims is that shortly after, the soldiers noticed a car resembling the car of the family who just buried the baby coming towards that location. And apparently, I don't know, the soldiers from some reason thought that they are the police, or I mean, I've never heard of the IDF being like very interested in criminal, you know, criminal non like that don't threaten Israeli citizens. But apparently these soldiers, from what I gathered, the claim is that, you know, they thought that it's the same car and they saw a dead baby. And so they wanted to stop it. And when it started driving towards the other direction, they shot towards its direction. It's all very, I'm kind of like, I'm not laughing, but it's, I mean, I think it's hard to hear this story and kind of, it's such a useless, I mean, there was no reason for them to shoot to this car. For me, it's just like the clearest sign of, you know, this whole cowboy mentality of soldiers in the West Bank. Why did you decide that, even if it really was the family of the baby who, or even if it was not, you know, let's say someone murdered the baby, like, since when does the IDF even like deal with these things? So for me, it's really like this mentality of, oh, I will just, you know, we'll just shoot towards a car. Like, who does that? You know, like in Israel, you are, according to the IDF, you're definitely not allowed to do that.
This shooting was against procedures?
Yes, it was against procedures. Of course, the army wouldn't say that now. But yeah, we do know what the procedures are. And the procedure definitely doesn't say that you can shoot a car that's driving towards the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. Where you haven't even recognized the car as, you know, as a definite car that was involved in something, you know, in a serious crime. I mean, you know, there was no basis to it, and it's very, very clear that it's against procedure. Of course, the army wouldn't confirm that, but, you know, that's why what journalists are for. I mean, I think that the first kind of question that we need to ask is, why were soldiers there to begin with?
Yeah.
Beit Umar is a town. It's, yeah, I think like very often called a village, but it's a town in the West Bank that in the past had very intense demonstrations on a weekly basis for years. There aren't any regular demonstrations there. But anyway, it's located right on Road 60. Road 60 is like the highway of the West Bank. It's where I think most of the traffic goes. It's the main road. And so you have a large share of settlers obviously driving this road, and also Palestinians. And this particular kind of, you know, piece of the road is always like connecting Jerusalem with Gush Etzion, which is this big settlement block. And so it's a very, you know, it's a busy road.
Yeah.
And there's actually a plan to widen it and to create a bypass, because right now the village is almost on the road. You have some of the town's structures right on the road. You have like a fuel station, you know. So there is a big army tower at the beginning. It's called Pillbox, at the entrance to the village. Now, you know, obviously I didn't speak to the person who decided to put that tower over there. But I think it's safe to assume that the reason why it exists is because this village is on the road. You know, roads are always this sensitive point where, you know, you could have stone throwing, you could have, you know, all sorts of attacks on a settler population. And therefore, the army is there. So the army is there essentially to protect settlers, which, you know, is the reason the army is basically all over the West Bank. So I think it's like an important point to make, because if there weren't soldiers there to begin with, this whole thing wouldn't have happened, because like nothing really happened in reality up until the point where a bunch of soldiers decided to like shoot towards a car, right? Like nothing, nobody murdered a baby, nobody, you know what I mean? Like there was no attack.
No stones were thrown at the
No stones, really, like so that was that. So I think it's important to remember that, just the presence of the soldiers is there for a reason, and hasn't it been for that, we probably, you know, this thing wouldn't have happened.
You spent several hours in the town, right, after the incident. Is this something that the local residents are talking about the permanent presence of IDF soldiers in their eyesight and in their faces every day?
Yeah, of course. And, you know, when I was there, so I actually came a day after the shooting. I came to the village, and I actually came very shortly before the funeral started. And, you know, the entrance, the main entrance to the village was blocked by the army because of the funeral. You know, it's just like you can't really ignore like being there. The like army tower is like really big. It's like, you know, it's part of the landscape. So like you can't really ignore it.
Yeah.
And also, you know, during the funeral. So the funeral kind of started from, you know, like the family's house. And then it came kind of closer to the point where like soldiers are. There obviously was like a massive presence of soldiers, even more than usually at the entrance to the village. And then when the funeral kind of like, you know, kind of got close, clashes started. I'm not sure whether it started because someone threw a stone or because, you know, the Israeli army, I don't know, threw a stun grenade. Like, I'm not sure, you know, you can rarely tell like who started this sort of thing, but it became like a full on, very intensive clash. And I was kind of like with the other journalists hiding at a family's house, hiding. I mean, you know, hiding slash trying to understand what's happening from a family's house. And they, you know, this house is like the very entrance to the village. So, you know, they told us how whenever there are protests or that turn into clashes, they like, you know, they get stones from one side, and then, you know, like the gas and stun grenades and like everything from the other side of the kind of stuck in the middle. Yeah, it's crazy, you know, like we spent some time at their house, and, you know, you see like babies and like, you know, children who like live, and then suddenly soldiers like knock on their doors because they want to use the balcony as like, you know, a position to, you know, shoot. I don't know. So yeah, so like it's very it was a very intense, just to see, you know, this like sort of thing, which this clash was like very a lot of people said that it was like very, very intense, even more than usual. But like, you know, on the other hand, like it's also daily life and reality and whatever.
And there was a fatality?
Yeah.
During that protest?
So there was a young Palestinian who was killed during the funeral. And he was shot using, so the IDF, you know, in like demonstrations or clashes or whatever you want to call, you know, like very often it's both, right? It's like both demonstration and a clash. And I don't know, I always have like a hard time kind of like defining, but anyway, so the IDF is obviously using rubber bullets and tear gas and skunk water, which is disgusting, and
which are meant to be non-lethal crowd control.
Which are
methods,
yeah,
right?
And then you have this rifle called the Ruger, which I think is actually American, and that is basically live fire that the IDF kind of uses as if it was. I mean it. It's considered to be less lethal than usual live fire, but actually what we see, the high number of casualties in recent months, a lot of them were, not casualties, fatalities, sorry, a high number of them were shot using Rogel. So for years, the IDF also defined it as non-lethal. Today, they, I think it was in 2000, I don't know, a couple of years ago, they kind of changed the definitions. I think today it's considered like less lethal.
That sounds like an oxymoron, semi-lethal weapon.
Yeah, it has to do with like...
It can half kill you.
Yeah, it's so, you know, it's not supposed to kill you if it's being pointed towards your feet or like from a certain distance. But in reality, what happens, and I don't know about the person who was killed in the funeral, but I can tell you of like other cases in which I checked, where, so Roger, if it's like aimed, you know, correctly, I guess, to like your feet, or it obviously injures, but it wouldn't kill you. But then when you use it in a demonstration, in a clash, where there are a lot of people around, obviously you could aim at someone that, but then this person moves, then, you know, it hits another person. Maybe this person, I personally kind of like investigated this story that happened, I think it was a year ago almost, in El Mughayr, which is a village near Ramallah, I guess you could say. Not really, but it's pretty close. So I investigated a case there where a teenager, I can't remember what his exact age was, I think around 13. He was killed during a demonstration slash clash in El Mughayr from Ruger. And then I went there and what I saw like at the site was that, you know, the soldiers were standing in like a higher spot and they shot towards someone who apparently was throwing stones. But according to eyewitnesses, that person, maybe they were aiming towards the legs. I don't know. Okay, I'm not sure. But anyway, so eyewitnesses said like maybe they shot towards this person. But when they did, you know, shortly before he moved. And then this boy who was standing like lower, even in a lower point, was shot. It hit him. I can't remember exactly where, but in one of the, like, you know, the vital organs and killed him. And so... why? And that to me, like one of the things that I, you know, I make a point of like reminding and like, you know, and tweet about it and like write about it occasionally is really like the use of Roger and the fact that it's being used very liberally as far as I can see. And I think this case that I've just talked about in El Mughayr shows how like you really shouldn't use it in a space where there is like, you know, a bunch of people. Maybe you aim towards someone. It hits another person where you, you know, so like, anyway.
It sounds like a very imprecise weapon. So, Hagal, some of these fatalities that we're talking about sound like they are part of the IDF's procedure. And whether we agree or disagree with the procedure, we can't have any complaints against the actual soldier who is following orders and adhering to the procedure. Is there any chance that the killing of Muhammad al-Alami will be taken seriously this time? Because as you said, it was against procedures. His father says that he has no confidence in the investigation until he sees the soldiers in court. And even when that happens, if we think back to the case of Elor Azaria, who served 9 months in prison for killing a neutralized Palestinian terrorist, he's right not to expect justice, right?
Yeah, I think he is right. I think that, you know, the system obviously covers up for the soldiers. First of all, because, and I think that's something that a lot of people in like the Israeli public would also say, you know, like we are sending these children or, you know, teenagers to serve in the army. And then obviously, you know, they are very young. They are doing mistakes.
Yeah.
And if the system doesn't back them up, if like they all end up in prison or something like that. So like, how can you then demand from another person to go to the army? Which, you know, I... I get that. I just think that you kind of need to stop after we are sending teenagers, you know, to these situations. And, you know, like, mm-hmm. obviously the case of Elor Zaria is very famous, but I think that there's this other case which I covered, which is about the killing of Ahmed Ben Nasre, which is also like a crazy, crazy, crazy story about a Palestinian who basically stopped to help another Palestinian who went through like a car accident. And so this teenager, I'm not sure he was a teenager, but he was very young, Ahmed Ben Nasre. He stopped at the side of the road, kind of helped this family. While he was helping the family, a soldier that was like on a tower mistaked him for someone else who the soldier thought threw stones before something, you know, and shot him dead. So in the end, this soldier was sentenced. It was like years after it actually happened, and he got 3 months of public service. So, you know, I mean...
So what then is behind? I mean, there has been an increase in the number of Palestinian fatalities over the last few weeks and months, right? And what is behind the increase? There doesn't seem to be a corresponding increase in the number of attacks against Israelis and against soldiers. So is the IDF's finger simply getting lighter on the trigger when it comes to policing demonstrations?
So I think one thing that like we need to put on the table, and that's a very major event, is that 7 Palestinians were killed from one village called Beta, and 6 of them were killed in demonstrations clashes around the outpost of Eviatar, which was established, I think it's all like less than 6 months ago, actually. It's like very, very recent.
Right. Established and then evacuated. And it's now empty, right? Eviatar.
Yeah. So Eviatar is also like, I think, an interesting story that got a lot of attention, at least in Israel. It's like an absurd story where there's this point like above the village of Beta and like on a road that's called a 505, which is like one of the main roads. It like connects what we call Tapuach Junction or Zatra Junction, like Palestinians call it, towards like the Jordan Valley. So it's like a pretty main road in the West Bank and a pretty like main point. And this point, settlers first tried to establish an outpost there like years ago after a man called Eviatar was killed in an attack that happened at a junction called Tapuach. Mm-hmm. And so it was like a couple of years ago where like they first went there, started this outpost, were like very quickly evacuated. Then a couple of months ago, there was another attack in Tapuach Junction where another young man called Yehuda Guetta was killed. He was shot. And shortly after, settlers came to the same point where, you know, the first Eviatar outpost was established. And so they went up there, weren't evacuated, and very quickly started to like build like proper houses from concrete, which is like, I don't know how, you know, like when we talk about outposts, like people don't know, but there are like a lot of different kind of outposts. It's like not one thing, you know, they have this sort of outpost where it's like a, you know, just like a teenager and like his goats and like this cardboard structure. Then you have outposts which are actually like villas, just like very like old outposts which are actually just very similar to all the other settlements, but just like were never really formally legalized. And Eviatar was this like weird combination of like, you know, something that happened like very quickly, very out in the spotlight, like no one kind of like noticed, because shortly after they started establishing it, the whole, you know, war and like everything started around here. And so very quickly they constructed like concrete buildings, and they had like a fundraising campaign online, and they raised a lot of money. And, you know, what happens in the West Bank is that an outpost is being established. And then soldiers come there to guard the outpost, because even though it's illegal, and, you know, we had Benny Gantz, who's like the defense minister, saying how it's all very illegal, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, at the end of the day, the IDF's mission is to protect, you know, Israelis. And so even if these Israelis are doing something illegal, they are there to protect there. And like very quickly, there was this sort of like, you know, military point there. And so the people of the village of Beta, and not only the village of Beta, but like Yatma, but like the village of Beta, like started doing daily demonstrations below the outpost, because, you know, the outpost is like on a hill, and then below, yeah, and then below is the village. And so they started demonstrating there, and people were just killed. Obviously, the demonstrations, a lot of them were like violent, you know, with like stone throwing and etc. And so you saw this like increase in Palestinian fatalities. You know, like suddenly what happened was that this area where like you had no clashes, no demonstrations, like nothing, there was like nothing happening there before, suddenly became this like major, you know, clashing point, and like a very, and you know, and suddenly you had to bring more soldiers over there because, you know, there were, because the Palestinians were very, very persistent. Mm-hmm. And then at a certain point, they also started burning like massive amounts of tires, which annoyed the settlers even more. Anyway, I mean, it all became like a big mess. But like, once again, like you had this situation where like, there was no situation before. There were no, like, there, you know, there was no clash in that particular point before. And like, because of the outpost, suddenly, you know, you have this.
And one provocation leads to another provocation, leads to escalation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it was absurd because at the end, the agreement that the settlers came to with the government was that they will, you know, self-evacuate, but the structures won't be demolished. And the civil administration, which is like the government, like the military government, would survey the land to see if it could declare it state land, which means like, you know, land that is like owned and like managed by the state, and then allocate it to the settlers. So, you know, it's this crazy situation where like you have people doing something illegal, and, you know, obviously, I mean, even, you know, even if we like let go of the like illegality of like part of it, like for a few weeks, you know, what the military did in the West Bank was like just allocate more and more forces to this specific point. And it's like they drove all the system crazy. You know, it was also just after the like the new government was established, and like suddenly, you know, you had like everyone kind of like talking about Avyatar, this thing, and what will happen, and like why? Because they decided to go up there. Like what? Okay, obviously I'm not that naive, you know, but like, so it's this crazy thing, and you know, like the civil administration does this like land surveys like all over the West Bank, but it does its job very slowly. And as far as I know, the land where Avyatar was, that wasn't the plan to like survey it now, you know, like, so you also have the settlers kind of like dictating what they would do. And that, it's like all, you know, so twisted. Yeah. And until today, it's like a closed military zone. The structures are still there. There's still military there because in the agreement, they say that like we, you know, we will only evacuate if there will be a police, not a police, like a military force that will guard the place because they don't want the Palestinians up there, right? So there's actually like, I was there like a week ago. I just like went. I was like, oh, okay, let's see if I can go in because I was, you know, I was in there before, and like, no, you can't. There's like a checkpoint.
There are soldiers guarding an abandoned.
Yes.
Outpost.
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. Abandoned it is very. Yeah. But yeah, and empty.
Yeah.
And the clashes with Beta like still continue. Not as forcefully as they were like when, you know, the settlers were actually there. But yeah. And so yeah. So that's like a very major thing that happened and caused, once again, like six Palestinians. There was another Palestinian who was killed last week in Beta in sort of like an unrelated incident. Gideon Levy wrote about it during the weekend. But that's a major thing that happened. I think another thing, if like we go back to the original question about about the rise in air fatalities, the other thing is, you know, during the war or like, you know,
it feels like a long time ago. Let's remind listeners that there was a conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza in, was it May?
It was May.
It was May. It feels like months ago.
Yeah, right. But like, you know, it's also like it was a conflict between Hamas and Israel, but it was also like a lot was happening inside Israel as well. And a lot was happening in the West Bank as well. So, you know, like, so a lot was happening at the same time. And there, you know, whenever there's like, you know, tension or a war or whatever, however you want to call it, because I don't know. So you obviously have more demonstrations or more clashes or more whatever. Mm-hmm. Obviously in like times where, you know, there's like heightened tension. So the military is also like cracking down more forcefully on like clashes, demonstrations and whatever. And like in general, there's like more happening because, you know, like we're also, so I think like the past year and a half in the West Bank was like relatively calm, saying it from obviously an Israeli perspective, but you know, like there was corona and, you know, like nobody was out of their house. Like obviously things were happening, but I think in like a bit of a lower pace, you know, we were all like in lockdown and stuff. Yeah. So like, that's also in like juxtaposition to like what we saw in May. So there was, yeah. So the crackdown was like even more, and what we are kind of like starting to like also reveal or like find out now is that during that month and a bit after as well, like you see a few scenes where, you know, soldiers and settlers are kind of like cracking down together, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is not a new phenomenon. We've talked before about how the settlers are almost the armed militia of the IDF, and the IDF is almost the bodyguards of the settlers. And you recently reported that there were videos of settlers using IDF weapons to shoot at Palestinians. So in that context, is there any sign that the new government, the government of change, remember, is cracking down on the lawless settlers in the same way that the IDF is cracking down on lawless Palestinians?
No. Listen, like, I think with the new government, like, we are obviously, like, yet to find out what it will do exactly.
I think maybe we've already discovered exactly what it will do, which is the nothing that it's done so far.
Yeah, true. I do think that, like, on the one hand, like, you do have in this government politicians who are maybe a bit, you know, just a bit less vulgar in their support of like violence towards Palestinians. Because really, like in the last government, like you really had people who were kind of like saying, like, you know, you should kill our, like, you know. Like,
but you also have, I mean, Meretz is in the coalition, and which is pretty much the only left-wing party in Israel. And you have the Arab parties in. So it's, are none of them, or is this one of the subjects that's just going to get forgotten about?
So I think like that's, so on one hand, you have like what I said, which is like, you know, a bit more like, yeah, a bit less like vulgar like support for violence. On the other hand, what we see now is like you have Meretz in the coalition, and you have you know, the Labour Party, and you know, and you have obviously Ram, which is like the Islamist party, let's say. There is another leftist party. It's just not
it's
in
a
the
question
government.
Of definition.
I think that the Communist Party is quite left wing, but it's not, obviously the Communist Party is not in the coalition. What we see now is that like politicians who we previously saw, you know, were very vocal about their opposition to the occupation and to like settler violence, etc., are now like keeping it a bit on the low. Like, you know, we have, for example, like you have Nitzan Horovitz, who's like the health minister, and you have Tamar Zandberg, who is the environment minister, and you also have Merav Michaeli. Merav Michaeli, she's the transportation minister. She's the head of the Labour Party. She is, as far as I know, like pretty left-wing in her opinions when it comes to like these subjects as well. I can't remember hearing anything from them. Mm-hmm. You do obviously have like Meretz, like, you know, members of Knesset who are vocal, like you have Gabi Lasky, who's a lawyer, who represented a lot of Palestinians, and she actually visited Eviatar together with Mossi Raz, who's like another member of Meretz. But they are not, you know, ministers. And I think that it's very clear that, you know, this government, which is composed from like different, you know, different players from, you know, across the political spectrum, they're trying very, very hard to like not rock the boat.
Exactly.
Today, talking about the occupation is obviously very outside of the consensus. And I think that, yeah, I think that they're what a lot of them are saying to themselves right now is like, what good will it do? You know, we will just like do the job that we can do now. And, you know, work on the stuff that we can, like, move forward, which I guess has to do more with, like, internal Israeli causes rather than, you know, the occupation, which obviously, like, when you're in government, like, your prime minister is Naftali Bennett, and, like, you have Ayelet Shaked, who's, like, the director of her office, lives in an outpost in a house with demolition order. And, you know, you have Gideon Saar, who, like, my first encounter ever with Gideon Saar was like 2 years ago. There was yet another election campaign, and he decided to go to Khan el-Ahmar, which is this Palestinian village that is threatened with evacuations for years and years now. And he just did this like tour of, don't worry, he didn't actually enter Khan el-Ahmar because, you know, why would he? So, like, he was above Khan el-Ahmar, kind of like looking down, talking about how, you know, we should evacuate them all and they're all infiltrated and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, so obviously with this sort of coalition, like, you know, why rock the boat?
Yeah.
And I do think that it's quite disappointing, because if you look, for example, at the last Meretz campaign, their campaign was actually very much about the occupation. Like, I actually found it to be quite surprising, but like they actually talked about it, one of their like flagship topics in their campaign. So, you know, so kind of like now saying nothing is, you know.
Yeah, well, expectation management, I think, is the key when it comes to this kind of coalition. Hagar, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap things up there for this week. Thank you for your time, as always.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, too, to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich, and to you, listener. We'll be back again on Friday with another episode of Haaretz Weekend. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.